but ever so slowly the ground might be shifting. As the data on worker disengagement earlier in the chapter reveal, the costs in both human satisfaction and organizational health are high when a workplace is a no-flow zone. That's why a few enterprises are trying to do things differently. As Fast Company magazine has noted, a number of companies, including Microsoft, Patagonia, and Toyota, have realized that creating flow-friendly environments that help people move toward mastery can increase productivity and satisfaction at work. For example, Stefan Falk, a vice president at Ericsson, the Swedish telecommunications concern, used the principles of flow to smooth a merger of the company's business units. He persuaded managers to configure work assignments so that employees had clear objectives and a way to get quick feedback. And instead of meeting with their charges for once-a-year performance reviews, managers sat down with employees one-on-one 6 times a year, often for as long as 90 minutes, to discuss their level of engagement and path toward mastery. The flow-centered strategy worked well enough that Ericsson began using it in offices around the world. After that, Falk moved to Green Cargo, an enormous logistics and shipping company in Sweden. There, he developed a method of training managers in how flow worked. Then, he required them to meet with staff once a month to get a sense of whether people were overwhelmed or underwhelmed with their work, and to adjust assignments to help them find flow. After 2 years of managerial revamping, state-owned Green Cargo became profitable for the first time in 125 years, and executives cite its newfound flow-centricity as a key reason. In addition, a study of 11,000 industrial scientists and engineers working at companies in the United States found that the desire for intellectual challenge, that is, the urge to master something new and engaging, was the best predictor of productivity. Scientists motivated by this intrinsic desire filed significantly more patents than those whose main motivation was money, even controlling for the amount of effort each group expended. That is, the extrinsically motivated group worked as long and as hard as their more type I colleagues, they just accomplished less, perhaps because they spent less of their work time in flow. And then there's Genova Chen, a young game designer who in 2006 wrote his MFA thesis on Csikszentmihalyi's theory. Chen believed that video games held the promise to deliver quintessential flow experiences, but that too many games required an almost obsessive level of commitment. Why not, he thought, design a game to bring the flow sensation to more casual gamers? Using his thesis project as his laboratory, Chen created a game in which players use a computer mouse to guide an on-screen amoeba-like organism through a surreal ocean landscape as it gobbles other creatures and slowly evolves into a higher form. While most games require players to proceed through a fixed and predetermined series of skill levels, Chen's allows them to advance and explore any way they desire. And unlike games in which failure ends the session, in Chen's game, failure merely pushes the player to a level better matched to her ability. Chen calls his game Flow, and it's been a huge hit. People have played the free online version of the game more than 3 million times. The paid version, designed for the PlayStation game console, has generated more than 350,000 downloads and collected a shelf full of awards. Chen used the game to launch his own firm, That Game Company, built around Flow, that quickly won a 3-game development deal from Sony, something almost unheard of for an unknown startup run by a couple of 26-year-old California game designers. Green Cargo, That Game Company, and the companies employing the patent-cranking scientists typically use 2 tactics that their less savvy competitors do not. First, they provide employees with what I call Goldilocks tasks, challenges that are not too hot and not too cold, neither overly difficult nor overly simple. One source of frustration in the workplace is the frequent mismatch between what people must do and what people can do. When what they must do exceeds their capabilities, the result is anxiety. When what they must do falls short of their capabilities, the result is boredom. Indeed, Csikszentmihalyi titled his first book on autotelic experiences, Beyond Boredom and Anxiety. But when the match is just right, the results can be glorious. This is the essence of flow. Goldilocks tasks offer us the powerful experience of inhabiting the zone, of living on the knife's edge between order and disorder, of, as painter Fritz Scholder once described it, walking the tightrope between accident and discipline. The second tactic that smart organizations use to increase their flow friendliness and their employees' opportunities for mastery is to trigger the positive side of the Sawyer effect. Recall from Chapter 2 that extrinsic rewards can turn play into work. But it's also possible to run the current in the other direction and turn work into play. Some tasks at work don't automatically provide surges of flow, yet still need to get done. So the shrewdest enterprises afford employees the freedom to sculpt their jobs in ways that bring a little bit of flow to otherwise mundane duties. Amy Rzhnewski and Jane Dutton, two business school professors, have studied this phenomenon among hospital cleaners, nurses, and hairdressers. They found, for instance, that some members of the cleaning staff at hospitals, instead of doing the minimum job required, took on new tasks, from chatting with patients to helping make sure nurses' jobs go more smoothly. Adding these more absorbing challenges increased these cleaners' satisfaction and boosted their own views of their skills. By reframing aspects of their duties, they help make work more playful and more fully their own. Even in low-autonomy jobs, Rzhnewski and Dutton write, employees can create new domains for mastery. The Three Laws of Mastery. Flow is essential to mastery, but flow doesn't guarantee mastery, because the two concepts operate on different horizons of time. One happens in a moment. The other unfolds over months, years, sometimes decades. You and I each might reach flow tomorrow morning, but neither one of us will achieve mastery overnight. So how can we enlist flow in the quest for something that goes deeper and endures longer? What can we do to move toward mastery, one of the key elements of type I behavior, in our organizations and our lives? A few behavioral scientists have offered some initial answers to these questions, and their findings suggest that mastery abides by three somewhat peculiar laws. Mastery is a mindset. As with so many things in life, the pursuit of mastery is all in our head. At least that's what Carol Dweck has discovered. Dweck, a psychology professor at Stanford University, has been studying motivation and achievement in children and young adults for nearly 40 years, amassing a body of rigorous empirical research that has made her a superstar in contemporary behavioral science. Dweck's signature insight is that what people believe shapes what people achieve. Our beliefs about ourselves and the nature of our abilities, what she calls our self-theories, determine how we interpret our experiences and can set the boundaries on what we accomplish. Although her research looks mostly at notions of intelligence, her findings apply with equal force to most human capabilities. And they yield the first law of mastery. Mastery is a mindset. According to Dweck, people can hold two different views of their own intelligence. Those who have an entity theory believe that intelligence is just that, an entity. It exists within us in a finite supply that we cannot increase. Those who subscribe to an incremental theory take a different view. They believe that while intelligence may vary slightly from person to person, it is ultimately something that, with effort, we can increase. To analogize to physical qualities, incremental theorists consider intelligence as something like strength. Want to get stronger and more muscular? Start pumping iron. Entity theorists view it as something more like height. Want to get taller? You're out of luck. If you believe intelligence is a fixed quantity, then every educational and professional encounter becomes a measure of how much you have. If you believe intelligence is something you can increase, then the same encounters become opportunities for growth. In one view, intelligence is something you demonstrate. In the other, it's something you develop. The two self theories lead down two very different paths, one that heads toward mastery and one that doesn't. For instance, consider goals. Dweck says they come in two varieties, performance goals and learning goals. Getting an A in French class is a performance goal. Being able to speak French is a learning goal. Both goals are entirely normal and pretty much universal, Dweck says, and both can fuel achievement. But only one leads to mastery. In several studies, Dweck found that giving children a performance goal, say, getting a high mark on a test, was effective for relatively straightforward problems, but often inhibited children's ability to apply the concepts to new situations. For example, in one study, Dweck and a colleague asked junior high students to learn a set of scientific principles, giving half of the students a performance goal and half a learning goal. After both groups demonstrated they had grasped the material, researchers asked the students to apply their knowledge to a new set of problems, related but not identical to what they just studied. Students with learning goals scored significantly higher on these novel challenges. They also worked longer and tried more solutions. As Dweck writes, with a learning goal, students don't have to feel they're already good at something in order to hang in and keep trying. After all, their goal is to learn, not to prove they're smart. Indeed, the two self theories take very different views of effort. To incremental theorists, exertion is positive. Since incremental theorists believe that ability is malleable, they see working harder as a way to get better. By contrast, says Dweck, the entity theory is a system that requires a diet of easy successes. In this schema, if you have to work hard, it means you're not very good. People therefore choose easy targets that, when hit, affirm their existing abilities, but do little to expand them. In a sense, entity theorists want to look like masters without expending the effort to attain mastery. Finally, the two types of thinking trigger contrasting responses to adversity, one that Dweck calls helpless, the other mastery-oriented. In a study of American 5th and 6th graders, Dweck gave students 8 conceptual problems they could solve, followed by 4 they could not, because the questions were too advanced for children that age. Students who subscribed to the idea that brain power is fixed gave up quickly on the tough problems and blamed their lack of intelligence for their difficulties. Students with a more expansive mindset kept working in spite of the difficulty and deployed far more inventive strategies to find a solution. What did these students blame for their inability to conquer the toughest problems? The answer, which surprised us, was that they didn't blame anything, Dweck says. The young people recognized that setbacks were inevitable on the road to mastery and that they could even be guideposts for the journey. Dweck's insights map nicely to the behavioral distinctions underlying Motivation 2.0 and Motivation 3.0. Type X behavior often holds an entity theory of intelligence, prefers performance goals to learning goals, and disdains effort as a sign of weakness. Type I behavior has an incremental theory of intelligence, prizes learning goals over performance goals, and welcomes effort as a way to improve at something that matters. Begin with one mindset, and mastery is impossible. Begin with the other, and it can be inevitable. Mastery is a pain. Each summer, about 1,200 young American men and women arrive at the United States Military Academy at West Point to begin 4 years of study and to take their place in the fabled long gray line. But before any of them sees a classroom, they go through 7 weeks of cadet basic training, otherwise known as Beast Barracks. By the time the summer ends, 1 in 20 of these talented, dedicated young adults has dropped out. A group of scholars, 2 from West Point, another from the University of Pennsylvania, and a 4th from the University of Michigan, wanted to understand why some students continued on the road toward military mastery and others got off at the first exit. Was it physical strength and athleticism? Intellect? Leadership ability? Well-roundedness? None of the above. The best predictor of success, the researchers found, was the prospective cadet's ratings on a non-cognitive, non-physical trait known as grit, defined as perseverance and passion for long-term goals. The experience of these Army officers in training confirms the second law of mastery. Mastery is a pain. As wonderful as flow is, the path to mastery, becoming ever better at something you care about, is not lined with daisies and spanned by a rainbow. If it were, more of us would make the trip. Mastery hurts. Sometimes, many times, it's not much fun. That is one lesson of the work of psychologist Anders Ericsson, whose groundbreaking research on expert performance has provided a new theory of what fosters mastery. As he puts it, many characteristics once believed to reflect innate talent are actually the results of intense practice for a minimum of 10 years. Mastery of sports, music, business requires effort, difficult, painful, excruciating, all-consuming effort. Over a long time, not a week or a month, but a decade. Sociologist Daniel Shambliss has referred to this as the mundanity of excellence. Like Ericsson, Shambliss found, in a 3-year study of Olympic swimmers, that those who did the best typically spent the most time and effort on the mundane activities that readied them for races. It's the same reason that, in another study, the West Point grit researchers found that grittiness, rather than IQ or standardized test scores, is the most accurate predictor of college grades. As they explained, whereas the importance of working harder is easily apprehended, the importance of working longer without switching objectives may be less perceptible. In every field, grit may be as essential as talent to high accomplishment. Flow enters the picture here in two ways. If people are conscious of what puts them in flow, they'll have a clearer idea of what they should devote the time and dedication to master. And those moments of flow in the course of pursuing excellence can help people through the rough parts. But in the end, mastery often involves working and working and showing little improvement, perhaps with a few moments of flow pulling you along, then making a little progress, and then working and working on that new, slightly higher plateau again. It's grueling, to be sure. But that's not the problem. That's the solution. As Carol Dweck says, effort is one of the things that gives meaning to life. Effort means you care about something, that something is important to you and you are willing to work for it. It would be an impoverished existence if you were not willing to value things and commit yourself to working toward them. Another doctor, one who lacks a PhD but has a plaque in the Basketball Hall of Fame in Springfield, Massachusetts, puts it similarly. Being a professional, Julius Erving once said, is doing the things you love to do on the days you don't feel like doing them. Mastery is an asymptote. To understand the final law of mastery, you need to know a little algebra and a little art history. From algebra, you might remember the concept of an asymptote. An asymptote is a straight line that a curve approaches but never quite reaches. From art history, you might remember Paul Cézanne, the 19th century French painter. You needn't remember much, just that he was significant enough to have art critics and scholars write about him. Cézanne's most enduring paintings came late in his life. And one reason for this, according to University of Chicago economist David Gallinson, who studied the careers of artists, is that he was endlessly trying to realize his best work. For Cézanne, one critic wrote, the ultimate synthesis of a design was never revealed in a flash. Rather, he approached it with infinite precautions, stalking it, as it were, now from one point of view, now from another. For him, the synthesis was an asymptote toward which he was forever approaching without ever quite reaching it. This is the nature of mastery. Mastery is an asymptote. You can approach it. You can home in on it. You can get really, really, really close to it. But like Cézanne, you can never touch it. Mastery is impossible to realize fully. Tiger Woods, perhaps the greatest golfer of all time, has said flatly that he can, that he must become better. He said it when he was an amateur. He'll say it after his best outing or at the end of his finest season. He's pursuing mastery. That's well known. What's less well known is that he understands that he'll never get it. It will always hover beyond his grasp. The mastery asymptote is a source of frustration. Why reach for something you can never fully attain? But it's also a source of allure. Why not reach for it? The joy is in the pursuit more than the realization. In the end, mastery attracts, precisely because mastery eludes. The oxygen of the soul. The subjects were displaying the warning signs of generalized anxiety disorder, a mental illness that afflicts roughly 3% of the adult population. According to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, DSM-4, the presence of any three of the following six symptoms indicates what could be a serious problem. Restlessness or feeling keyed up or on edge. Being easily fatigued. Difficulty concentrating or mind going blank. Irritability. Muscle tension. Sleep disturbance. These men and women seem textbook cases. One person, who had previously glided through life with equanimity, now felt tense, more hostile, angry, and irritated. Another reported being more irritable, restless, and suffering from shorter concentration. Yet another scribbled this self-description: slept badly, listless, more nervous, more guarded. Some people feared they were having a nervous breakdown. One person's mind was so muddied that he inadvertently walked into a wall and broke his glasses. Time for a trip to the psychiatrist or a prescription for anti-anxiety medicine? No. It was time for people to let flow back into their lives. In the early 1970s, Csikszentmihalyi conducted an experiment in which he asked people to record all the things they did in their lives that were non-instrumental. That is, small activities they undertook not out of obligation or to achieve a particular objective, but because they enjoyed them. Then he issued the following set of instructions. Beginning on the morning of the target date, when you wake up, and until 9 p.m., we would like you to act in a normal way, doing all the things you have to do, but not doing anything that is play or non-instrumental. In other words, he and his research team directed participants to scrub their lives of flow. People who liked aspects of their work had to avoid situations that might trigger enjoyment. People who relished demanding physical exercise had to remain sedentary. One woman enjoyed washing dishes because it gave her something constructive to do, along with time to fantasize free of guilt, but could wash dishes only when absolutely necessary. The results were almost immediate. Even at the end of the first day, participants noticed an increased sluggishness about their behavior. They began complaining of headaches. Most reported difficulty concentrating, with thoughts that wander around in circles without getting anywhere. Some felt sleepy, while others were too agitated to sleep. As Csikszentmihalyi wrote, after just 2 days of deprivation, the general deterioration in mood was so advanced that prolonging the experiment would have been unadvisable. 2 days, 48 hours without flow, plunged people into a state eerily similar to a serious psychiatric disorder. The experiment suggests that flow, the deep sense of engagement that Motivation 3.0 calls for, isn't a nicety, it's a necessity. We need it to survive. It is the oxygen of the soul. And one of Csikszentmihalyi's more surprising findings is that people are much more likely to reach that flow state at work than in leisure. Work can often have the structure of other autotelic experiences. Clear goals, immediate feedback, challenges well matched to our abilities. And when it does, we don't just enjoy it more, we do it better. That's why it's so odd that organizations tolerate work environments that deprive large numbers of people of these experiences. By offering a few more Goldilocks tasks, by looking for ways to unleash the positive side of the Sawyer effect, organizations can help their own cause and enrich people's lives. Csikszentmihalyi grasped this essential reality more than 30 years ago when he wrote, "There is no reason to believe any longer that only irrelevant play can be enjoyed, while the serious business of life must be borne as a burdensome cross. Once we realize that the boundaries between work and play are artificial, we can take matters in hand and begin the difficult task of making life more livable." But if we're looking for guidance on how to do this right, on how to make mastery an ethic for living, our best role models are probably not sitting around the boardroom table or working in the office down the hall. Over lunch, Csikszentmihalyi and I talked about children. A little kid's life bursts with autotelic experiences. Children careen from one flow moment to another, animated by a sense of joy, equipped with a mindset of possibility, and working with the dedication of a West Point cadet. They use their brains and their bodies to probe and draw feedback from the environment in an endless pursuit of mastery. Then, at some point in their lives, they don't. What happens? You start to get ashamed that what you're doing is childish, Csikszentmihalyi explained. What a mistake. Perhaps you and I and all the other adults in charge of things are the ones who are immature. It goes back to Csikszentmihalyi's experience on the train, wondering how grown-ups could have gotten things so wrong. Our circumstances may be less dire, but the observation is no less acute. Left to their own devices, Csikszentmihalyi says, children seek out flow with the inevitability of a natural law. So should we all. Chapter 6. Purpose. We know from statisticians that demographics is destiny. And we know from the Rolling Stones that you can't always get what you want. What we don't know is what happens when these two indomitable principals sit down, pour themselves a drink, and get to know each other better. But we're about to find out. In 2006, the first members of the baby boom generation began turning 60. On birthdays with big round numbers, people usually stop, reflect, and take stock of their lives. And I've found that when boomers in the United States and elsewhere reach this milestone, they typically move through a three-stage reaction. In the first stage, they ask, "How the heck did I get to be 60? When their odometer flips to 60, people are often surprised and slightly alarmed. 60, they think, is old. They tally their regrets and confront the reality that Mick Jagger and crew were right, that they didn't always get what they wanted. But then the second stage kicks in. In the not-so-distant past, turning 60 meant that you were somewhat long in the tooth. But at the beginning of the 21st century, anyone who's healthy enough to have made it 6 decades is probably healthy enough to hang on a fair bit longer. According to United Nations data, a 60-year-old American man can expect to live for another 20-plus years. A 60-year-old American woman will be around for another quarter of a century. In Japan, a 60-year-old man can expect to live past his 82nd birthday. A 60-year-old woman to nearly 88. The pattern is the same in many other prosperous countries. In France, Israel, Italy, Switzerland, Canada, and elsewhere, if you've reached the age of 60, you're more than likely to live into your 80s. And this realization brings with it a certain relief. Phew, the boomer in Toronto or Tokyo sighs, I've got a couple of more decades. But the relief quickly dissipates, because almost as soon as the sigh fades, people enter the third stage. Upon comprehending that they could have another 25 years, 60-year-old boomers look back 25 years to when they were 35, and a sudden thought clonks them on the side of the head. "Wow, that sure happened fast," they say. "Will the next 25 years race by like that? If so, when am I going to do something that matters? When am I going to live my best life? When am I going to make a difference in the world?" Those questions, which swirl through conversations taking place at boomer kitchen tables around the world, may sound touchy-feely, but they're now occurring at a rate that is unprecedented in human civilization. Consider, boomers are the largest demographic cohort in most Western countries, as well as in places like Japan, Australia, and New Zealand. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, the United States alone has about 78 million boomers, which means that on average, each year more than 4 million Americans hit this soul-searching, life-pondering birthday. That's more than 11,000 people each day, more than 450 every hour. In other words, in America alone, 100 boomers turn 60 every 13 minutes. Every 13 minutes, another 100 people, members of the wealthiest and best educated generation the world has ever known, begin reckoning with their mortality and asking deep questions about meaning, significance, and what they truly want. 100 people, every 13 minutes, every hour of every day until 2024. When the cold front of demographics meets the warm front of unrealized dreams, the result will be a thunderstorm of purpose, the likes of which the world has never seen. The purpose motive. The first two legs of the Type I tripod, autonomy and mastery, are essential. But for proper balance, we need a third leg, purpose, which provides a context for its two mates. Autonomous people working toward mastery perform at very high levels. But those who do so in the service of some greater objective can achieve even more. The most deeply motivated people, not to mention those who are most productive and satisfied, hitch their desires to a cause larger than themselves. Motivation 2.0, however, doesn't recognize purpose as a motivator. The Type X operating system doesn't banish the concept, but it relegates it to the status of ornament, a nice accessory if you want it, so long as it doesn't get in the way of the important stuff. Yet by taking this view, Motivation 2.0 neglects a crucial part of who we are. From the moment that human beings first stared into the sky, contemplated their place in the universe, and tried to create something that bettered the world and outlasted their lives, we have been purpose seekers. Purpose provides activation energy for living. Psychologist Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi told me in an interview, "I think that evolution has had a hand in selecting people who had a sense of doing something beyond themselves." Motivation 3.0 seeks to reclaim this aspect of the human condition. Baby boomers around the world, because of the stage of their lives and the size of their numbers, are nudging purpose closer to the cultural center. In response, business has begun to rethink how purpose figures in what it does. As an emotional catalyst, wealth maximization lacks the power to fully mobilize human energies, says strategy guru and boomer Gary Hamel. Those staggering levels of worker disengagement I described in the previous chapter have a companion trend that companies are only starting to recognize, an equally sharp rise in volunteerism, especially in the United States. These diverging lines, compensated engagement going down, uncompensated effort going up, suggest that volunteer work is nourishing people in ways that paid work simply is not. We're learning that the profit motive, potent though it is, can be an insufficient impetus for both individuals and organizations. An equally powerful source of energy, one we've often neglected or dismissed as unrealistic, is what we might call the purpose motive. This is the final big distinction between the two operating systems. Motivation 2.0 centered on profit maximization. Motivation 3.0 doesn't reject profits, but it places equal emphasis on purpose maximization. We see the first stirrings of this new purpose motive in three realms of organizational life: goals, words, and policies. Goals. Boomers aren't singing alone in their chorus of purpose. Joining them and using the same hymn book are their sons and daughters, known as Generation Y, the Millennials, or the Echo Boomers. These young adults, who have recently begun entering the workforce themselves, are shifting the center of gravity in organizations by their very presence. As the writer Sylvia Hewlett has found in her research, the two bookend generations are redefining success and are willing to accept a radically remixed set of rewards. Neither generation rates money as the most important form of compensation. Instead, they choose a range of non-monetary factors, from a great team to the ability to give back to society through work, And if they can't find that satisfying package of rewards in an existing organization, they'll create a venture of their own. Take the case of American Gen Yer Blake Mikoski and Tom Shoes, the company he launched in 2006. Tom's doesn't fit snugly into the traditional business boxes. It offers hip, canvas, flat-soled shoes, but every time Tom sells a pair of shoes to you, me, or your next-door neighbor, it gives away another pair of shoes to a child in a developing country. Is Tom's a charity that finances its operation with shoe sales? Or is it a business that sacrifices its earnings in order to do good? It's neither. And it's both. The answer is so confusing, in fact, that Tom's Shoes had to address the question directly on its website, just below information on how to return a pair that's too big. Tom's, the site explains, is a for-profit company with giving at its core. Got it? No? Okay, try this. The company's business model transforms our customers into benefactors. Better? Maybe. Weirder? Certainly. Ventures like Tom's blur, perhaps even shatter, the existing categories. Their goals and the way companies reach them are so incompatible to Motivation 2.0 that if Tom's had to rely on this 20th century operating system, the whole endeavor would seize up and crash in the entrepreneurial equivalent of a blue screen of death. Motivation 3.0, by contrast, is expressly built for purpose maximization. In fact, the rise of purpose maximizers is one reason we need the new operating system in the first place. As I explained in Chapter 1, operations like Tom's are on the vanguard of a broader rethinking of how people organize what they do. For-benefit organizations, B corporations, and low-profit limited liability corporations all recast the goals of the traditional business enterprise. And all are becoming more prevalent as a new breed of business person seeks purpose with the fervor that traditional economic theory says entrepreneurs seek profit. Even cooperatives, an older business model with motives other than profit maximization, are moving from the shaggy edge to the clean-cut center. According to writer Marjorie Kelly, in the last three decades, worldwide membership in co-ops has doubled to 800 million people. In the United States alone, more people belong to a co-op than own shares in the stock market. And the idea is spreading. In Colombia, Kelly notes, Salud Co-op provides healthcare services to a quarter of the population. In Spain, the Mondragon Corporación Cooperativa is the nation's seventh largest industrial concern. These not-only-for-profit enterprises are a far cry from the socially responsible businesses that have been all the rage for the last 15 years, but have rarely delivered on their promise. The aims of these Motivation 3.0 companies are not to chase profit while trying to stay ethical and law-abiding. Their goal is to pursue purpose and to use profit as the catalyst rather than the objective. Words. In the spring of 2009, as the world economy was reeling from a once-in-a-generation crisis and the financial shenanigans that stoked it, a few Harvard Business School students glanced in the mirror and wondered if they were the problem. The people they'd aspired to be, financiers, corporate dealmakers, weren't, it turned out, heroes in an epic tale, but villains in a darker story. Many of these high-profile business people were the ones who pushed the financial system to the brink. Meanwhile, these young men and women looked among their classmates and saw the seeds of similar behavior. In one survey of MBA students a few years earlier, a whopping 56% admitted to cheating regularly. So a handful of Harvard second years, fearing that what was once a badge of honor had become three scarlet letters, did what business students are trained to do. They made a plan. Together they fashioned what they called the MBA Oath, a Hippocratic oath for business grads in which they pledge their fealty to causes above and beyond the bottom line. It's not a legal document. It's a code of conduct. And the conduct it recommends, as well as the very words it uses, leans more toward purpose maximization than profit maximization. From the first sentence, the oath rings with the sounds of Motivation 3.0. As a manager, my purpose is to serve the greater good, by bringing people and resources together to create value that no single individual can create alone. It begins. And on it goes for nearly 500 words. I will safeguard the interests of my shareholders, co-workers, customers, and the society in which we operate, the oath taker's pledge. I will strive to create sustainable economic, social, and environmental prosperity worldwide. These words, purpose, greater good, sustainable, don't come from the Type X dictionary. One rarely hears them in business school because, after all, that's not what business school is supposed to be about. Yet students at arguably the world's most powerful MBA factory thought otherwise. And in just a few weeks, roughly one quarter of the graduating class had taken the oath and signed the pledge. In launching the effort, Max Anderson, one of the student founders, said, "My hope is that at our 25th reunion, our class will not be known for how much money we made or how much money we gave back to the school, but for how the world was a better place as a result of our leadership." Words matter, and if you listen carefully, you might begin to hear a slightly different, slightly more purpose-oriented dialect. Gary Hamel, who I mentioned earlier, says, "The goals of management are usually described in words like efficiency, advantage, value, superiority, focus, and differentiation. Important as these objectives are, they lack the power to rouse human hearts. Business leaders," he says, "must find ways to infuse mundane business activities with deeper, soul-stirring ideals such as honor, truth, love, justice, and beauty. Humanize what people say, and you may well humanize what they do." That's the thinking behind the simple and effective way Robert B. Reich, former U.S. Labor Secretary, gauges the health of an organization. He calls it the pronoun test. When he visits a workplace, he'll ask the people employed there some questions about the company. He listens to the substance of their response, of course, but most of all, he listens for the pronouns they use. Do the workers refer to the company as they, or do they describe it in terms of we? They companies and we companies, he says, are very different places. And in Motivation 3.0, we wins. Policies. Between the words businesses use and the goals they seek sit the policies they implement to turn the former into the latter. Here, too, one can detect the early tremors of a different approach. For example, many companies in the last decade spent considerable time and effort crafting corporate ethics guidelines. Yet, instances of unethical behavior don't seem to have declined. Valuable though those guidelines can be, as a policy, they can unintentionally move purposeful behavior out of the Type I schema into Type X. As Harvard Business School professor Max Bazerman has explained, say you take people who are motivated to behave nicely, then give them a fairly weak set of ethical standards to meet. Now, instead of asking them to do it because it's the right thing to do, you've essentially given them an alternate set of standards. Do this so you can check off all these boxes. Imagine an organization, for example, that believes in affirmative action, one that wants to make the world a better place by creating a more diverse workforce. By reducing ethics to a checklist, suddenly, affirmative action is just a bunch of requirements that the organization must meet to show that it isn't discriminating. Now the organization isn't focused on affirmatively pursuing diversity, but rather on making sure that all the boxes are checked off to show that what it did is okay and so it won't get sued. Before, its workers had an intrinsic motivation to do the right thing, but now they have an extrinsic motivation to make sure the company doesn't get sued or fined. In other words, people might meet the minimal ethical standards to avoid punishment, but the guidelines have done nothing to inject purpose into the corporate bloodstream. The better approach could be to enlist the power of autonomy in the service of purpose maximization. Two intriguing examples demonstrate what I mean. First, many psychologists and economists have found that the correlation between money and happiness is weak, that past a certain and quite modest level, a larger pile of cash doesn't bring people a higher level of satisfaction. But a few social scientists have begun adding a bit more nuance to this observation. According to Lara Acknon and Elizabeth Dunn, sociologists at the University of British Columbia, and Michael Norton, a psychologist at the Harvard Business School, how people spend their money may be at least as important as how much money they earn. In particular, spending money on other people, buying flowers for your spouse rather than an MP3 player for yourself, can actually increase our subjective well-being. So can spending money on a cause, say donating to a religious institution rather than going for an expensive haircut. In fact, Dunn and Norton proposed turning their findings on what they call pro-social spending into corporate policy. According to the Boston Globe, they believe that companies can improve their employees' emotional well-being by shifting some of their budget for charitable giving so that individual employees are given sums to donate, leaving them happier even as the charities of their choice benefit. In other words, handing individual employees control over how the organization gives back to the community might do more to improve their overall satisfaction than one more if-then financial incentive. Another study offers a second possible purpose-centered policy prescription. Physicians in high-profile settings like the Mayo Clinic face pressures and demands that can often lead to burnout. But field research at the prestigious medical facility found that letting doctors spend one day a week on the aspect of their job that was most meaningful to them, whether patient care, research, or community service, could reduce the physical and emotional exhaustion that accompanies their work. Doctors who participated in this trial policy had half the burnout rate of those who did not. Think of it as 20% time with a purpose. The good life. Each year, about 1,300 seniors graduate from the University of Rochester and begin their journey into what many of their parents and professors like to call the real world. Edward Deci, Richard Ryan, and another colleague decided to ask a sample of these soon-to-be graduates about their life goals, and then to follow up with them early in their careers to see how they were doing. While much social science research is done with student volunteers, scientists rarely track students after they've packed up their diplomas and exited the campus gates. And these researchers wanted to study the post-college time frame because it represents a critical development period that marks people's transitions to their adult identities and lives. Some of the University of Rochester students had what the researchers label extrinsic aspirations. For instance, to become wealthy or to achieve fame, what we might call profit goals. Others had intrinsic aspirations, to help others improve their lives, to learn and to grow, or what we might think of as purpose goals. After these students had been out in the real world for between 1 and 2 years, the researchers tracked them down to see how they were faring. The people who'd had purpose goals and felt they were attaining them reported higher levels of satisfaction and subjective well-being than when they were in college, and quite low levels of anxiety and depression. That's probably no surprise. They'd set a personally meaningful goal and felt they were reaching it. In that situation, most of us would likely feel pretty good too. But the results for people with profit goals were more complicated. Those who said they were attaining their goals, accumulating wealth, winning acclaim, reported levels of satisfaction, self-esteem, and positive affect no higher than when they were students. In other words, they'd reached their goals, but it didn't make them any happier. What's more, graduates with profit goals showed increases in anxiety, depression, and other negative indicators, again, even though they were attaining their goals. These findings are rather striking, the researchers write, as they suggest that attainment of a particular set of goals, in this case profit goals, has no impact on well-being and actually contributes to ill-being. When I discussed these results with Deci and Ryan, they were especially emphatic about their significance, because the findings suggest that even when we do get what we want, it's not always what we need. People who are very high in extrinsic goals for wealth are more likely to attain that wealth, but they're still unhappy, Ryan told me. Or, as Deci put it, the typical notion is this: you value something, you attain it, then you're better off as a function of it. But what we find is that there are certain things that if you value and if you attain them, you're worse off as a result of it, not better off. Failing to understand this conundrum, that satisfaction depends not merely on having goals, but on having the right goals, can lead sensible people down self-destructive paths. If people chase profit goals, reach those goals, and still don't feel any better about their lives, one response is to increase the size and scope of the goals, to seek more money or greater outside validation. And that can, in the words of Richard Ryan, drive them down a road of further unhappiness, thinking it's the road to happiness. One of the reasons for anxiety and depression in the